Hello and welcome to the Spectator's Books podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of the Spectator. And this week we're going to be talking about the third most famous Dane in history after Hamlet and Scooby-Doo, Søren Kierkegaard. I'm joined by Claire Carlisle, who's the author of a new book, Philosopher of the Heart, The Restless Life of Søren Kierkegaard. Claire, welcome. Now, to most of us, Kierkegaard is someone who maybe we've encountered at undergraduate level in a, you know, Penguin Classics edition of Fear and Trembling, and that's about as far as we go. Is that the sort of heart of his work? I mean, it's a big question to ask you to sum up straight away, but, you know, what's the nub of why Kierkegaard's important?
Well, he's often seen as the first existentialist philosopher or the father of existentialism, but as the title of my book suggests, he was called by his contemporaries the philosopher of the heart. And what that means is that he really directed his philosophical attention to the inner life of human beings, the human condition as lived from the inside. And that's really, that focus on the heart and on the experience of being human is what is very distinctive about him, and it's the reason why his writings have touched so many people. I mean, they've been translated into all sorts of different languages. And that focus on the human condition and the experience of anxiety and despair and hope and all the other aspects of being human has fed into the existentialist tradition, but it's also done more than that, particularly in the way he is a great critic of religion, but also he's still exploring human spirituality.
Yes, well, I was going to say that, you know, surely the one big break between him and the existentialists is that they were generally how you navigate in a godless world, weren't
yes,
they? And
he's yes.
quite the opposite.
Yes, yes, that's right. Yeah, I mean, Kierkegaard was baptized a Lutheran. Like most Danes in the 19th century, he was just brought up as a Christian. And so he did his thinking within that tradition. He was very, he always questioned the Christian tradition that he was a part of. And actually at the end of his life, he launched an outright attack on the church, but he never left the church. So he was a kind of critical voice within it. And rather than saying that we need to leave religion behind, like some of the 20th century existentialists did, he was trying to think about how human beings could live a truer kind of spirituality rather than just conforming to institutional religion. So in that sense, he's a religious thinker.
Yes, I mean, does it make sense to think of him as a theologian rather than a philosopher?
Well, I think he is a philosopher. He's also a theologian. He's also a religious thinker, religious writer, literary writer. It's quite difficult to pin Kierkegaard down for these reasons. And in a way, that's something that's very... It's one of the reasons why he's a great thinker, that he's difficult to categorise, and he has as much to say to atheist philosophy as he does to, say, Christian theology. So that's one of the things that's very important and interesting about him.
And to sketch the sort of break he made, at least immediately, when he was starting to write, Hegel was sort of everywhere, wasn't he?
Yes, yes, he was a trendy philosopher
at
the
time.
He was
the trendy philosopher.
Yeah.
And, you know, how did Kierkegaard kind of kick against Hegel, and also in a way before him kind of Kant?
Well, I mean, in a way,
that's a long
story. But the feature of Hegel's philosophy that Kierkegaard really disliked was its aspiration to build a system of human knowledge, a very ambitious aim to really try and comprehend the whole of world history as well as metaphysics using human reason. So Hegel had a great confidence in human reason to make progress in not just scientific understanding, but also in religious understanding. And so he was part of a whole Enlightenment project, which was to really elevate human reason and to have reason be the highest authority on all sorts of political, social, moral questions. And the thing that Kierkegaard reacted against was precisely that aim to systematize our knowledge. And Kierkegaard is an anti-systematic thinker because he thinks that human experience doesn't fit neatly into a rational system. So when we're thinking about the human heart, it's much more of an emotional experience. And so he thinks that to translate the human being into sort of rational concepts is to miss out something crucial, which is, well, it's difficult to say what it is in a way, and that's part of his point, is that there's a lot that can't be expressed and that can't be articulated and that can't be argued about being human, but actually those things can be the most profound and most important parts of human life, and a rational system can miss out.
There's also a point you make in the book that it's very much struck me that you said, you know, the sort of Hegelian idea that, you know, you can generalize across history, and you can talk about it, or generalize across people, and come up with a theory of history, if you like, if that makes sense. That Kant said, you know, the important stuff is happening life by life. You know, you have to. I mean, he's very strongly individuating people, wasn't he?
He is, yes. I mean, he's sometimes criticised for being too individualistic. But I think his thought was really that individuals have to really know themselves most of all. And he was influenced by Socrates in this respect. You know, Socrates, the ancient Greek philosopher, told people that they should understand themselves, and they should try to inquire firsthand into the experience of being human and the question about what it is to be human. And Kircher took that Socratic injunction very seriously, and so he thought that, in a sense, that the attempt of Hegel and his followers to produce an encyclopedic understanding of world history, of nature, of societies, was in a sense a distraction from this more fundamental project of self-knowledge, which is really an ethical task. It's really the task of figuring out how to live. Each of us is, we're born, we're brought up in a certain society, and part of the process of growing up and becoming adults is to figure out who we are and how to live. So it's that first person task of understanding ourselves, or maybe realizing the extent to which we don't fully understand ourselves. That's primary for Kircher. But I think he did think that that project was always bound up with our relationships with other people. It's not an individualism that isolates people from each other. It's rather that, in fact, Kircher thought that our human relationships, our relationships with our parents, our children, our spouses or friends, that these were really some of the most essential parts of being human. So that's drawn into the philosophy of the heart that he's putting forward. It's not about separating people from each other.
But you express very well in the book how he sort of almost zings back and forth, particularly as a young man, between this idea of being involved in the world and an almost monastic retreat from it into interiority.
Yeah, that's definitely a big theme of the book, is that question about how to be in the world. And that is a question that Kircher inherits from the Christian tradition that he's born into, because that tradition, I mean, he was a Protestant thinker, as I said before, he was a Lutheran. And one of the big shifts that happened in the Reformation was a move from seeing monasticism as the highest form of religious life to seeing marriage and the family as the way in which you live a life and relate to God through in that more worldly way. And Luther himself exemplified that by leaving a monastery and getting married. And so, you know, it's a big difference between the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church, is that in Protestantism the clergy can marry, you know, so that's a big shift. And in a way, Kierkegaard's still grappling with that question, because what monasticism and marriage represent for him are two different ways of being in the world. So the monastic possibility is really about retreating from the world, withdrawing from the world, renouncing the world in order to focus on the relationship to God, whereas marriage represents a different kind of religious life, which involves being in the world and living a relationship to God through your worldly role as a parent, as a professional, as a member of society. So the fundamental question, I argue in the book, is this question about how to be in the world. And interestingly, Kierkegaard rejected both of these possibilities. He thought that he did have to be in the world. He thought that, I mean, he couldn't be a monk because there were no monasteries in Copenhagen in the 19th century. But his version of monasticism was leaving the city and retreating to a quiet place in the countryside, ceasing to be a writer because being a writer kept him in the public eye. So it wasn't a literal monasticism that he was tempted by, but it was still a kind of withdrawal from the world. But he felt that his vocation actually required him to be in the world, to be a writer, even though he found that quite difficult. And, you know, famously, he did plan to get married, but then he broke off the engagement. So he's, you know, he's almost like the opposite of Luther, in that Luther managed to be both a monk and a married man, although not at the same time, whereas for Kircher, neither possibility seemed really one that he could embrace, but he was still kind of dealing with this question about what his relationship in the world should
be. Talk maybe about this, you know, his own heart, and this, you know, he was one of history's worst fiancés.
Yes,
you
know? He's famous for breaking his engagement.
Exactly,
yes,
and he was engaged to Regina, I'm sure how you pronounce her.
Yeah, I think a Danish person would say Regina, but Regina is fine.
I'm sorry.
It's more natural for an English person to say Regina.
But then, almost immediately he broke it off, but it's the quality of that breaking off. It's not like he just had second thoughts, is it? It's something much more profound than that.
No, it was something very complex. So he knew Regina for, I think, 3 years before they got engaged, and then they were engaged for a year. So, you know, it's quite a long courtship, a long relationship in that respect. I think the day after he proposed to her, he felt that it was the wrong thing for him, but it did still take him a year to actually figure out what to do about that. I mean, it wasn't a decision that he took lightly, but he felt unable to marry for whatever reason. And there's been a lot of speculation about what those reasons might be, sort of psychological reasons that Kirchhoff was quite secretive about. In my biography...
Yes, you describe him maybe cutting out sections of his journal as well. Yes, extraordinary. There's a sort
That's right.
There's his private thoughts, and then his thoughts that are so private that he won't even
exactly.
keep them in
his
journal.
So he wrote journals every day, but he had a sense that these journals would probably be read and published after his death. So they don't necessarily reveal the real Kierkegaard. There's still a place where Kierkegaard's trying to craft his image, his public image. And yes, as I say in the book, when he wrote something that he really wanted to keep private, he would cut it out of his journal with a knife and presumably burn it. So we know that anything we read in his journals is, you know, to some extent it's Kierkegaard thinking things through for himself, but he's also censoring himself at the same time. So in a way it's difficult to reach a final explanation for why Kierkegaard couldn't marry, and I think actually he himself didn't fully understand why he couldn't marry, and so part of his writings, both his published writings and his journals, were his way of working through this very traumatic experience.
Well, fear and trembling is seen often, you know, that the Abraham Isaac framework that gives it its story. He casts Regina as Isaac and him as Abraham, is that right?
Well, maybe. I mean, that's open to interpretation. So he wrote this book, Fear and Trembling, which is about the biblical story of Abraham being prepared to sacrifice Isaac. He doesn't have to sacrifice him in the end. And Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling is about this story of the sacrifice. And he wrote in his journal, "He who has explained Abraham has explained my life." So it's clear that he saw himself somewhere in the story of Abraham. I think he also saw Regina somewhere in that story. But I don't think it's clear exactly how the story represents that relationship. So one way of reading it is that Regina is someone who has to be sacrificed for the sake of Kierkegaard's relationship to God, because he did see his vocation as a writer as a religious vocation, and he felt that he couldn't be a writer and married, because he knew that his writing would be controversial, would put him in the public eye, and he felt that it wouldn't be fair to subject a wife to that kind of thing. But he also felt that in order to be... He was quite idealistic about marriage, actually. He thought that husbands and wives should be completely open with each other, and he felt somehow unable to fully open himself to another person. So that was part of it as well. So one way of reading Fear and Trembling is to say, oh yes, well, you know, Regina's in the role of Isaac and Kierkegaard's Abraham, but it could also be the other way around, where he's asking Regina to sacrifice him and to give him up. And he did often see his authorship, his writings, as written for her and written to in some way help her come to terms with what had happened to her.
There's some extraordinary little details. I mean, that he kept this cabinet in his house.
Tell us
about the cabinet.
Yes,
I mean, that's...
I know. So after he... I'm not sure exactly when this happened, but sometime after he broke the engagement to Regina, he had a cabinet built out of rosewood, a beautiful cabinet that he designed himself, and he had it built. And this was apparently because when he was in the process of breaking up with poor Regina, she begged him to let her stay with him and said, "Look, I won't cause you any trouble. You know, I'll just live in a little cupboard as long as I can just sort of be with you." And so these words of hers about "just let me be with you and live in this cupboard" sort of somehow materialised into an actual cupboard that Kierkegaard had built, a cabinet that had no shelves. And it gives, you know, it's like an upright coffin or something, that, you know, this image of this cabinet that this woman is supposed to be
is
to be living in.
Somewhere,
it is, yes, right. It's in a museum in Copenhagen, you can see it. But what Kierkegaard did was use that cabinet as a kind of reliquary of their relationship. So he had special editions of each of his books printed.
Two
of each book, one for him and one for Regina, and he kept them them in the cupboard. He also kept, you know, other things that were sort of reminiscent of their relationship in this cupboard. So it was a kind of shrine in a sense. And year by year, you know, the books and papers in this cupboard mounted until it was full. So there is a sense in which his, and then, you know, at the end of his life, he dedicated his authorship to her, and he wrote a will leaving everything to her.
She refused them, though, didn't she?
She did refuse them. She, by this time, was married to someone else, and it wasn't seen to be appropriate that she should be drawn into this Kierkegaardian web that he was trying to draw her into.
She might still have been a bit pissed off as well.
Well, I mean, so interestingly, I don't think she was. I think she had a deep affection for Kierkegaard. She was happily married after the engagement. She had a long marriage to someone who actually became the governor of the Danish West Indies. But he died before she did. And after her husband died, Regina gave a couple of interviews where she talked about her relationship with Kierkegaard, who by this time was very famous. And she shows a great deal of affection for him. So it wasn't just one-sided. He kept thinking about her throughout his quite short life, but she also kept thinking about him through her very long life. So there was something between them that was very profound, I think. And this whole amazing authorship that he wrote is, I mean, it's philosophically very interesting. It's not all about a broken engagement, but somehow Regina's kind of in the mix with all that. And he saw his writings as a kind of monument to her, and the cabinet kind of, in a sense, represents that in a very material, very visible kind of way.
But it's also one of the, I mean, in the immediate aftermath of the engagement, which I found psychologically fascinating, I think it's either or, isn't it, that he writes a sort of polyphonic piece where one of the voices is this really horrible sort of Lovelace, Rochester seducer character.
Yes, yes.
Who's deeply manipulative. And
yes,
how
horrible,
do you read that? Yeah. Because as you say, it's hard to say, is that him reproaching himself or him imagining a version of himself to try and make Regina think, actually, he was horrible, I don't want anything to do with him.
Well, so his explanation for that was that he was trying to make it easier for Regina. He was trying to make her fall out of love with him by presenting himself as a heartless seducer, so that she would think she was just sort of better off without him and that she'd been deceived. Kierkegaard was really, this awful character. So he saw himself, in a sense, as sacrificing his reputation to help her to get over this very devastating, heartbreaking breakup. However, I think there's more to it than that. And I think that one of the things that Kierkegaard is quite keen to do in Either Or is to cultivate a kind of virile image of himself, because the way his breaking the engagement was often interpreted by other people was that he was somehow not up to it, that he was somehow unmanly. And of course, you know, in the 19th century, there are very, very strong ideas about what men should be like and what women should be like, even perhaps even more than we still have today. So there was an ideal of masculinity that I think Kierkegaard was seen as falling short of. And so this character of the Byronic seducer, who is perhaps, you know, seen on the one hand, it's maybe a way of Kierkegaard kind of undermining his reputation for Regina's sake, but perhaps it's also a way for him to try and build up his reputation and to say, oh, you know, it's not because I couldn't marry or I was somehow unmanly, which is the interpretation of the people were putting on it, but rather trying to prove his manliness. So there's a lot of, I mean, you could engage in endless speculation. And in a way, I've held back quite a lot in the book. I've tried to just present to the reader the material, hopefully in a way that's kind of makes a good story. But in a sense, I've left it to the reader to kind of think about some of these questions, and I've not tried to impose too much my own interpretation of this.
I mean, maybe that's for another book. But I was intrigued by that interpretation, particularly because there seems to be a theme that runs through the book of Kierkegaard. On the one hand, you know, having this contemptuous Mundi thing, but on the other, kind of minding quite a lot, you know, not being able to escape from his sort of bourgeois Copenhagen sense, minding what people thought of him, you know, why publish if you're so interior?
No, he minded enormously what people thought of him. But that's one of the things that, you could say, oh, he's hypocritical because he's sort of pretending not to mind, but actually he really minds. But I think that's a very, very human thing to do. I think we all do that a bit. We sort of pretend not to mind as much as we do often as a way of, you know, keeping our cool or trying to defend ourselves. But I think it's part of the human condition that we care about what other people think of us. And we're very conscious of the fact that other people are perceiving us. I mean, that's another big theme of the book, is that being in the world isn't just about our own relationship to the world. It's also about being conspicuous and being open to view. And that's what being in the world means for a human being as well. We're kind of on stage. I mean, you know, Shakespeare says all the world's a stage. And it's that idea of being on show and being quite conscious of the judgments of other people. And Kircher was incredibly conscious of all this. And he was, and in a way that I think is very human.
That comes later on. But...
Yes, yeah. So he was in his sort of mid-30s, he was parodied by a satirical weekly paper called The Corsair, a bit like Private Eye or something like that. And they ran a series of quite cruel cartoons and sketches, sort of written sketches, that showed Kircher's physical infirmity. So he was slightly, had a twisted spine, and he had very sort of thin legs. And, you know, so he was physically a bit sort of odd looking, and he wore slightly weird clothes as well. But it also made fun of his apparently very aloof and arrogant attitude towards his reading public. And yeah, so that was an experience where he was very literally, he was the image of him was literally presented to the world in a certain way, and he was very upset and very, very hurt by this.
And he spent a lot of time protesting he wasn't. But what kicked that off slightly was that he was initially praised in The Corsair, and yes, he was sort of annoyed to have praise from someone that you consider so low, while at the same time he wrote, I think the professor of philosophy was called Heiberg, yeah, and Bishop Myrtle, what's it called, Münster.
Bishop Münster, yeah.
You know, there were these two great, you know, major intellectual figures around him, who he was spending his whole time trying to knock them down. But he wrote, you know, a word of praise from them would be balm from heaven, because they're on my level.
Yes, exactly. So he was actually, again, I think a very human experience. He was quite disappointed about the fact that his works weren't recognised more than they were, and particularly by these very influential people. So the head of the Danish Church, Bishop Münster, Heiberg, who was a kind of literary editor and really kind of the kind of king of Danish literature. There was another, a third person called Professor Martinsen, who was a professor of theology. So these three men were, in a sense, each of them at the top of the fields that Kircher himself was working in, you know. And so he desperately wanted to impress them, and he wanted them to write glowing reviews of his writing. And when they either ignored his writings or wrote sort of lukewarm reviews, he was very, very disappointed and upset. And so then when he was praised by, you know, some less important person in The Corsair, he said, oh, you know, this is almost, you know, this is nothing to me. And so, yeah, I mean, he was a very psychologically complex person. I think partly he was so proud and so unable to just express his disappointment. He felt he had to conceal it under all these layers of bravado and kind of contempt, that he did invite the Corsair's attack on him in some ways.
This thing of concealment as well. I mean, in the first place, he wrote a fantastic amount. I mean, he had a sort of logorrhea. Also this business of him writing under pseudonyms constantly. How do you read that? Is that a sort of way of expressing contradictory points of view at one time, because he, you know, he was a very contradictory person, or was that a means of concealment, or ventriloquism?
Yes, well, I think that you used the word polyphonic earlier, and I think that's a good way to think about Kircher's authorship, is that he doesn't just, his books don't just set out philosophical theories, but they dramatise different attitudes to life. And so he invents different characters who hold different views of life and who make different kinds of life choices. And he shows, in a sense, these different life choices interacting, and so his use of, I mean, his pseudonyms are literary characters, in a sense. They're not just names that he uses, so that's part of his literary strategy, really. But it was actually quite common for people in the 19th century to write either anonymously or under pseudonym. So, you know, we shouldn't make too much of that. And actually, Kircher wrote quite a lot under his own name as well. So he wrote these many series of sermon-like religious discourses that he wrote under his own name, as well as these pseudonymous works. So he wasn't just hiding, because he was prepared to publish under his own name as well. But it's also true that he really anguished about whether to publish things once he'd written them. So he wrote all the time, but then found publication quite difficult, again, because it was putting himself out in the world and submitting himself to public judgment in a way that I think most authors can find a bit terrifying.
So he was sort of cross when his pseudonyms were outed as well, wasn't he? Or was that a matter of...
That's right, yes. Yeah, so in I think 1845, 1846, someone sort of wrote that Kirchhoff was actually exposed Kirchhoff as the author of these pseudonymous works, which I think was pretty much common knowledge. But Kirchhoff was angry that someone else had taken the liberty of doing that because he was very controlling about his authorship. He wanted to be in control of how it was read, how it was interpreted, and who he was as an author in relation to it. So he was very cross when someone else took that out of his control. So yes, his use of pseudonyms, like most other things about him, is quite complicated. So they're partly a literary device, but they also have, I think, roots in Kirchhoff's quite ambivalent relationship with publicity, with being visible and being seen in the world, putting himself out there.
Now, we've talked a bit about Regina. There's also, I mean, I don't know how Freudian interpretation you would put on it, but his relationship with his parents seems very, very interesting. I mean, you mentioned at one point that nowhere in his published or unpublished works does he mention his mother.
Yeah.
Which is extraordinary.
Yes. It's interesting that she's this sort of cipher in a way. And she was extremely important to Kirchhoff. So there's one thing I mentioned in the book is how a few weeks after his mother died when he was 21. So he was, you know, quite young. He was still a student, and he visited the mother of a friend of his a few weeks after she died, and she said that she'd never seen a human being so distressed as Kirchhoff was by the death of his mother. So she was obviously someone who was very important to him, and he never wrote about her, whereas his father, by contrast, is quite a notorious figure as a very influential figure on Kirchhoff, and Kirchhoff wrote quite a lot in his journals about his father and the fact that his father was quite a frightening and sort of brooding and melancholy figure who, in a sense, epitomised Kirchhoff's relationship to Christianity. Kirchhoff's father was quite a sort of pious, devout Christian, and so Kirchhoff was brought up in this Christianity by his father, and in many ways sort of conflated Christianity and his father, and he was very ambivalent to both of them.
Bishop Munster becomes a kind of father.
That's right. So Bishop Munster, who ends up being the leader of the Danish church, was a priest whom Kirchhoff's father really revered and respected, and went to him for confession and communion and so on. So Bishop Munster was someone who Kirchhoff's father had quite a close relationship to. And so, yes, after Kirchhoff's father died, Kirchhoff somehow sort of transferred his very ambivalent and very complicated feelings about his father and the Christianity that his father represented onto this poor Bishop Munster, who, you know, was sort of doing his best, really, to do a good job. You know, I think he was a good teacher, a good sort of representative of the church, but Kirchhoff had a very complicated relationship.
Yes,
you
should describe him with sort of, you know, approbation, but semi-faint praise in the context is saying, you know, he was this fantastic centrist and he was moderate in absolutely everything.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that was his great talent, really, was moderation and diplomacy. And, you know, that's a good quality to have if you're leading a church. But for Kirchhoff, he's a much more extreme character. He's an immoderate kind of thinker. And so he was very frustrated with Bishop Munster's sort of compromising. As he saw it, he saw Bishop Munster as compromising the Christian message.
Well, he has a line somewhere, I think, I can't remember whether it's of the Danish church, it might be of some of the philosophers, that he says it's like a ticket in a window, a ticket in a shop window. What's it?
Yes.
Can you remind me of that?
Yes, exactly. So that's a metaphor that Kirchhoff uses to describe philosophers, as well as being critical of Hegel's philosophy in particular. Behind that, and perhaps more interestingly, is a critique of the institution of academic philosophy. So Kirchhoff was critical of universities and academia in a similar way to the way he was critical of the church. He thought that what the church was presenting was a kind of cheapened version of true sort of human spirituality, and he also thought that what the universities were presenting was a cheapened version of wisdom.
In the sense that they're sort of commodified and mass-produced.
Yes, exactly, and shallow and so on.
Detached from.
So Kierkegaard compared Socrates very favourably to these sort of modern, as for him, 19th century professional philosophers who earned a living from teaching. And actually he was diagnosing something that's still very relevant today, which is the commodification of education. I mean, I work in a university and, you know, there's a kind of consumer culture in education, just as there is in many other parts of life. And that
so
was something
you might
that
have
was
to say about REF assessments.
Yeah, exactly. So that was something that was really beginning in the 19th century with the growth of the modern university. I mean, you know, I work at King's, which was founded during Kirchhoff's lifetime, for example. So yes, he was critical critical of this professionalised, consumerised institution for teaching wisdom, whereas he thought that wisdom wasn't necessarily to be found in textbooks or in lecture theatres, and that, again, it was a more existential, what we now recognise as existential in many ways due to Kierkegaard. Process of examining the human heart and living out philosophical questions through our lives and through the choices we make in our lives.
Can I ask also about the form of the book? Because you're approaching a very plural and complex figure, and you know, his life, his thought, and you haven't done the straight A to B biography. In fact, I think this is one of the sections has the dates are, you know, 1848 to 1813,
yes.
But you're actually going backwards.
Yes, yes.
Why and how did you set about organising your material?
So there's actually quite a good reason for that. So partly I wanted to write a book that as much as possible travelled with Kierkegaard through his life, rather than me writing in the 21st century, looking back on Kierkegaard, knowing everything I do about how he ended up being this super famous philosopher, rather to really be with the uncertainty that Kierkegaard himself experienced about whether the work he was doing was on the right lines and whether he was having any impact, because these were the kinds of anxieties that Kierkegaard had.
You use some quite novelistic techniques, don't you?
Yes.
Present tense.
Yes. So what that meant was that when I talk about Kierkegaard's childhood, I do that through Kierkegaard's own eyes. So in the late 1840s, when Kierkegaard was in his mid-30s, he went through a phase of writing a lot about his own childhood and really reflecting on his upbringing. And I wanted to present that material. So I show Kierkegaard looking back on his own life from the 1840s rather than looking back on his life from my point of view. But I don't begin with his childhood. As you say, that comes a bit later. So the first part of the book joins Kierkegaard in 1843, which is the year he published Either Or and Fear and Trembling and some other works as well. And this is really when he launched his authorship. And I think it's a relatively optimistic and hopeful time for him. You know,
he's coming back to Copenhagen.
Yeah, he's travelling from Berlin to Copenhagen. Either Or was published a couple of months earlier and it was really successful. Everyone's talking about it. And, you know, he's excited. He's excited about his career and the books he's about to publish to follow Either Or. So I begin with that. And that's because I wanted to give people a reason to care about Kierkegaard's childhood. I kind of felt that if I just began at the beginning with Kierkegaard's childhood, then people wouldn't necessarily know why they should be interested in how this person's parents and what his childhood was like. Whereas I thought if I began... So there are four chapters that really talk about Kierkegaard as this writer of the books that made him famous, Either Or and Fear and Trembling, show what his concerns are, talk a bit about the broken engagement as the context for these writings, talk about the fact that he's doing this new kind of philosophy, he's critiquing academia, talk about who his opponents were, and give some context for who Kierkegaard was and really introduce people to Kierkegaard for a bit. And then in part two, to then say, okay, so who is this person? How did he become this kind of weird, eccentric, brilliant philosopher who we've just met, and then to kind of give the backstory. And yeah, to do that through his eyes. So the book tries to stay quite close to Kierkegaard's own perspective because, yeah, I wanted to convey the experience, so Kierkegaard's philosophy is really about what he called inwardness, the inner drama of being a human being and the anxieties and the uncertainty that we feel as we move through life facing an open future. And I wanted to convey some of that experience, which is really at the heart of Kierkegaard's philosophy, in writing about his life and showing Kierkegaard living his life and how that life that he lived ended up being translated into these philosophical books.
Yeah, it's obviously unconscionably reductive to ascribe his philosophy to a pathology, say.
Yes,
but
yes.
Do you think, I mean, he did suffer depression throughout his life and anxiety. Do you think he was, to some extent, what we'd now recognise as mentally ill? And do you think that affected the way he wrote? I mean, do you think there's aspect of
well,
this?
Well, I mean, in a way, I'm a bit reluctant to diagnose Kierkegaard. But if I was to diagnose him, I would probably say he...
It's a parlour game, we're allowed.
Yes, that probably a manic depressive would be the right way to describe him because he was incredibly creative and he'd stay up all night writing. He had these astonishing bursts of creativity. And so he described the cycle of writing and production in terms that sound a bit like a sort of manic depressive. Like he talks about the kind of dark phase of the cycle where he's feeling completely despairing, and then suddenly he's kind of lifted out of himself and he's able to just write without stopping, and then he's completely exhausted. So there's definitely this kind of cycle of creativity and of production that you know, that I mean, you can pathologize that. I mean, I think we probably medicalize and pathologize a bit too much nowadays. So if according to a modern diagnosis, then that might be fitting. But on the other hand, he's an artist. He's a creative person, and he's turbulent and he's unstable. And I'm not saying that all artists are unstable and turbulent, but actually, it's quite a common feature of great artists that they do have to suffer for their art. And Kich was someone who suffered inwardly. You know, he didn't suffer externally, because he actually was quite well off, and he inherited a lot of money from his father. Although his money did run out by the end of his life, so he ended up quite poor when he died. But yes, yeah, but he suffered a lot for his art, and we can medicalize that if we want to, but there's also perhaps some more sort of romantic reading of that that we can also keep in mind. And yeah,
I don't know whether it's an overgeneralization, but he's sort of out of fashion at the moment, I think. I mean, you might disagree, but can I ask, he is a philosopher whose work is so inward and so rooted in his particular experience as a human being, and at the same time he's a philosopher who's, you know, profoundly theistic and connected to spiritual.
Yes.
How much can those two things make him a philosopher who allow him to be a philosopher who speaks to us now as you know, a general experience in a secular age?
Yes. Well, I think very much so. I mean, I teach Kircher to my students at King's, and they have very diverse backgrounds. You know, they have come from different religious backgrounds, and many of them not at all religious. And obviously, they're all interested in religion because they're choosing to study Kircher with me. But I don't think that you have to be religious to read Kircher. I mean, I think people who are actually very, very hostile to religion can kind of feel a bit impatient with Kircher, because he is sort of very much caught up in this religious worldview. But I think when we step back from that and look at the deep questions that Kircher is asking about how to be a human being and how to be in the world, which are the questions I've foregrounded in the book, I think those are questions that we can all relate to. And really, the issue for Kircher in writing about Christianity is about authenticity. It's about the difference between being a kind of fake or shallow version of being a Christian and being a true Christian. And that distinction between what's authentic and what's inauthentic is one that we can take into many different kinds of identities that we might be invested in. So, yeah, I think that's one way of showing that Kircher is... he's grappling with a certain identity, and in a sense we're all born into a certain time and place, and we all inherit a certain kind of culture, and we live in a society that has values which we may or may not buy into, and we have to navigate that experience. And Kircher's someone who's navigating, you know, a path through his own culture and his own society. We live in a different world, you know, 200 years later. But I think the existential questions, the questions about how to be human, are similar questions. So even though we may not share Kircher's beliefs, I mean, I don't share Kircher's beliefs, at least not fully, I think there's something very inspirational about his courage in not shying away from the full range of human experience, including anxiety and despair and suffering, which I think are universal human experiences. That's not to glorify them and say we should be suffering more than we are or anything. It's rather to say, well, yes, you know, we do suffer, and we can deal with that by trying to run away from it and trying to avoid it and distract ourselves from it, or we can really inquire into it and sort of go into that experience.
That line
and
works.
Sort of,
I think it's not why we suffer, he asked, he put it, as you put it, but how we suffer.
Yes, yeah. So there's a sort of abstract, and within a kind of Christian framework, people often pose this question, like, why do we suffer? Why would God allow us to suffer if God is, you know, perfect and omnipotent and so on? And that's the sort of theological question that, in a sense, I see as quite... I mean, it's a live question for people who believe in God, but that's actually not the question that Kircher was most concerned with. That's a question that's called the problem of evil. You know, like, why would a God allow the world to be full of suffering if, you know, if God exists? Whereas I think for Kierkegaard, it's more that given that we do suffer, how do we live well with that suffering? You know, what's the right kind of response to it? How do we deal with our suffering? And for him, you know, that was a sort of religious, spiritual question. And I think for many people, suffering isn't actually an argument against religious belief. It's more like a reason for it. You know, it's because being human is quite sort of confusing, and we're not quite sure why we're here and what we're doing. And existentially, it's quite sort of disorienting, just sort of finding yourself as a human being in the world and trying to figure out how you're supposed to live. And for many people, religion, different religions, provide a kind of path through some of those questions. They're not supposed to provide easy answers. And I think Kierkegaard was very suspicious of any kind of religious teaching that provided easy answers. Rather, he actually thought that, you know, it was a case of really grappling with the difficulty of life, and that was where real wisdom could be found, by going into the difficulty rather than trying to stand back from it and avoid it.
Claire Carlisle, thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you for having me.
We hope you enjoyed that book's podcast. If you did, I very much hope that you'll subscribe to us on your podcast provider. And if you liked it, especially if you liked it, please rate and review it very favourably indeed. We also have a special offer. We can provide a £20 John Lewis voucher if you subscribe to 12 issues of the magazine for just £12. So that's practically an £8 bribe to read The Wonderful Spectator for 12 weeks running. And you just need to go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.